And it's the first signs of what really, I think, emerges now as Trump's foreign policy, which is Israel is not only an asset, it is actually an anchor to American power in the region. And the more Israel understands its regional role and employs its power to secure its part of the Middle East, the more that helps the United States and helps us focus elsewhere in the world.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what is happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Mahab Harkov, your co-host, Misgav Senior Fellow, and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider. Misgav Institute Executive Director Asher Fredman, our usual co-host, is not available this week. But hopefully he'll be back next week. And we will continue to bring you fresh insights into the most critical developments in Israel and the Middle East. So please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. We read and respond to all of your comments. Thank you to those who have sent us feedback. I am not going to do another monologue this week. We're going to go straight to our guest, who was super, super interesting. I thought of calling him. We have analyst David Wormser, who I thought of calling because of a few things that have been in the news. Number one, the recent passing of Vice President Dick Cheney. And number two, there have been all these strange conspiracy theories going around some of the darker corners of the internet. Some of the people who have been very critical of Israel in the U.S., critical to the point of just being anti-Israel, and they've been tying Israel to the Iraq War, which, for those of us who lived through it, know that that's absurd. And so I wanted to bring someone on who really knew, who was really sort of in the rooms where decisions were made. So we have analyst David Wormser, who's an American foreign policy specialist and a member of the Misgav Institute's board. Wormser was a Middle East advisor to former Vice President Dick Cheney and a special assistant to John Bolton in the State Department. And we are very excited to have him on the podcast this week. David Wormser, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Absolutely a pleasure to be on.
I thought of inviting you on for a number of reasons, but most recently is that Dick Cheney has been in the news. I think you knew him very well as his Middle East advisor. So maybe let's open. We'll talk to you a little bit about him and his legacy on U.S. foreign policy and defense.
Yeah, I mean, those of us who knew him knew kind of a different figure than the public persona that he's been sort of portrayed as. One, he was actually quite soft-spoken and quite kind. But also, he was a man of ideas. But by that, I mean not ideology. He was not stubborn or set in his views per se. He certainly was firm in many of his views. But he was always willing to take on board criticism, sometimes withering criticism. And more often than not, I remember he changed his mind. There were a couple times when I was working for him, I wrote memos, and I came home to my wife that night and said, I just wrote the mother of all memos that will get me fired. And sure enough, you know, I was in his office the next morning, and he was basically saying, hadn't thought of it that way, but maybe I should. And so that's really, he was a man, in my view, who lived in the world of ideas. And I don't think that's fully appreciated, that he genuinely was reading about conservative ideas. Tevi Troy, another guy who worked in the White House at the time, not for him, but in the White House, but knew him before the White House years from the American Enterprise Institute. Tevi went on to become in health and human services and so forth in the Bush in a Bush administration and the Trump administration. He knew Vice President Cheney pretty well too, and that's one thing he's been making a point about in his public comments. And I have to really reinforce that he's a man of ideas who very deeply cared about the coherence and getting it right from a conservative point of view?
You know, I was a teenager, basically growing up in America during the Iraq War. And I happened, and I was pretty right-leaning on these things anyway, from 9/11. I saw it from a very, you know, my mother's Israeli, so I saw it from the, you know, broader picture of terrorism in the Middle East. But a lot of my peers and just the way Dick Cheney was portrayed, they saw him as almost like a cartoon villain. Was that something that bothered him, you know, that people thought he was this scary guy? Or do he feel comfortable because he knew, he believed in what he was doing?
Well, he took on board what people were saying, and but no, I don't think it really bothered him all that much. He knew what he was, he knew what he thought. He had pretty strong values. He knew that a lot of this was politics. He had been around for 20, 30 years before.
Yeah.
He knew what this town, Washington, can produce in terms of nastiness. So he wasn't all that fazed by that. He was bothered by a number of things, though. One was obviously the treatment of Scooter Libby. That bothered him a lot. The second thing was what he felt was the administration's lack of strategic vision and the inability he had to try to move it toward a greater coherence in terms of strategy. And then finally, I think what really got to him was the Iraq War itself, not the war, but the fact that when things started getting tough in late 2004 and 2005, you know, Washington is a town where you have a lot of fathers when you're doing well, but you're an orphan when you're not. And the Iraq War became an orphan. And nobody was willing to really stick their neck out to continue to work on it, to make it succeed. And yet we had hundreds of thousands of troops who were there, and many more who had been there and given their lives or had come home but given part of their lives. And he felt it really devastated him to know how orphaned it had become as a public policy issue. So he really spent the last 4 years of his life in the White House before he retired, really focusing on the Iraq War, because he felt that he owed it to the soldiers who were there to prosecute this all the way. And he was deeply involved in some critical decisions then that in retrospect were important decisions to turn this thing around and to make sure that this big investment didn't completely go to waste and all the people who had sacrificed so much had spent their sacrifice on wasting.
So I want to get back to the Iraq War, but let's finish up with my last question about Dick Cheney, which is, I think maybe a lot of people are not so aware of his sort of contributions and his view and the contributions to the U.S.-Israel relationship and his views on Israel. Because other people maybe were a little bit more at the fore at the time, but maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Look, he was a loyal vice president, so he would never diverge from the president's policy. And when he strongly disagreed with it, he would let his views be known, but within proper channels. So first of all, he had an 80% rule that if something is more than you know less than 20% off the rails, so to speak, just ignore it. It's not worth fighting over. More than that, you try to help, you try to bend it, and if it's really off the rails, you fight it, but you fight it, as I said, through the proper channels. So that was really how he proceeded forward.
His views on the big Israel issues, I understood that he internally opposed the Gaza disengagement, for example, and later on when he was no longer, he was a big opponent of the Iran deal, which Israel strongly opposed and has seen.
In public or in his meetings after the war even, you wouldn't see very much light of day between him and President Bush, simply because he was loyal and he didn't believe that was his role to kiss and tell and to cross the president even afterwards. But that said, I do know there were issues that he did differ with the president. The first, of course, was Iran. There was definitely two waves of push. One was the Colin Powell attempt, along with Sawyers from Great Britain, which believed that once we were in Iraq, the Shiite question was a terribly difficult one, and that we could stabilize Iraq if we would reach out to the Iranians and help get them, enlist them to help us stabilize the Shiites in Iraq. So they didn't think there was a way around this without stabilizing the Shiites in Iraq through Iran. And of course, the president or the vice president, I think the president too, but the vice president fundamentally rejected that. He thought that the Iranians were up to no good, period. There was no deal with them possible. They were as much of an enemy as anybody in the Middle East. And moreover, the Shiites needed to be ripped from the orbit of the Iranians rather than thrown into the grip of the Iranians. So he understood that framework early on and thought it was a fundamental mistake. The second part of it was he began to see the violence in Iraq as an extension of Iranian subversive war against the United States in Iraq. And while, again, Colin Powell, therefore, would try to appease the Iranians to come to a deal, he felt that Syria and Iran were fundamental enemies, and that therefore this only highlighted the issue that the United States has to consider seriously how to fight this subversive war that Iran has thrust on us. A larger concern he always had was, and this comes out of the Cold War, the defeat of the Soviet Union, a man who really, he was alive in World War II, but he wasn't very old, so he doesn't remember it per se. But he grew up in its shadow, and his older, everybody older than him by 10 years had actually was fighting in World War II. And he understood that American power, not just the actual amassing of power or the application of power, but the stature of American power, was critical to stabilizing the world architecture, the post-war order. And as a result, everything that was going on in the Middle East with Iran and Iraq, he filtered through this prism of, is this going to tarnish the United States as a respected regional power? Because if it does, it will rebound very badly toward the United States. And it'll be an uphill struggle. And then no matter what investment you put in the Middle East, it will get deeper and harder, and you just won't be able to turn it. So for him, the Iraq War became also a critical element that needed to establish the credibility of American power. And the war that Iran was prosecuting against us in Iraq became such a litmus test. Then in that framework, of course, you could understand where he was on the nuclear program. He was not for the Paris Accords. He was very much upset by the tripartite letter that Iran received from Britain, the United Kingdom, and France. He felt it was a big mistake. He felt that there was no engagement with the Iranian regime on this issue, and in fact, that was more or less the American policy at that point, despite the fact that there were feelers sent out by Colin Powell and others. The problem was the Europeans understood this, and they tried to isolate Colin Powell inside the U.S. government. But he was definitely against this whole diplomatic process with the Iranians. He felt they had cheated enough. The evidence was there. Those who want to see it will see it. And that we have to move toward taking it out of the IAEA to the UN Security Council and moving toward sanctions. As far as this engagement, he never said anything overtly this way or that way about disengagement. But I do remember one meeting, which we had. It was me and my immediate superior, John Hanna, and his advisor, Scooter Libby, along with Vice President Cheney. And we were meeting with Mayor Dagan, and he expressed grave concerns that disengagement was not properly thought through. Again, he actually projected onto Israel the same sort of image that he had toward the United States, that Israel's stature was critical to Israel's deterrence, that Israel's stature was critical towards stabilizing its part of the Middle East. And he was very concerned that disengagement could be seen as weakness. And as a result, he expressed some concerns about that. He didn't express opposition. He expressed concerns that this is an issue that needs to be addressed and that he was worried about it.
And arguably, he was probably right. I mean, a lot of things were poorly thought out, let's say, with the way the disengagement ended up happening. So I want to go back to the Iraq War. For more than 20 years, there's been a public conversation in the U.S. about it, but I feel like it's become very loud lately. A lot of talk about the legacy of the Iraq War, and specifically voices who have been blaming Israel for it in the right-wing podcast sphere. I don't even know if we want to call them right-wing, but in the podcast sphere. And I was wondering if you wanted to sort of set the record straight about where things were between Israel and the U.S. relating to the Iraq War.
In a nutshell, all these debates about it are off base. Israel opposed it. Israel did not think it was a good idea. We got an earful from Mori Lubrani. We got an earful from Farkash. We got an earful from Sharon. We got an earful from a lot of Israeli officials who simply thought we were not focused on the right things. There were two elements to the critique from Israel. First of all was, it's the wrong enemy. You should be worried about Iran, not Iraq. And you are going off on an adventure that will detract from your real strategic interest to contain and reverse the Iranian nuclear program. The second part of it was, you know, this whole freedom agenda. Israel was far more skeptical toward it and felt that we were building way too much on a free Iraq on two levels. One is Iraq being reconstructed into a modern, more powerful country, even if free, was a strategic concern for Israel. They weren't convinced that that would necessarily be a friendly country. And the second thing is they believed that Ahmad Chalabi, we heard this over and over again from intelligence officials and so forth, they believed that he was aligned with, maybe even an agent of, Iran. So there really was nothing to the idea that Israel supported the war, or worse, finagled or manipulated America into a war with Iraq. They bitterly may be too strong a word, but they were vehemently opposed. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Israel being opposed to the quote-unquote freedom agenda in Iraq. I feel like that's a pattern that continues with Israel, especially when it comes to the Palestinians, right? That Condoleezza Rice wrote extensively in her book, right, about the U.S. trying to bring democracy to Gaza and then Hamas rising. The Trump administration's 2020 peace plan, and now in their Gaza plan, they talk about reform in the Palestinian Authority, and Netanyahu has made pretty clear that, yeah, I'll agree to these plans because I don't really think it's going to happen. But now the Trump administration and other countries of the world are really pushing something in Gaza, which in the immediate term or in the short to medium term might not be that, but in the long term is looking a little bit like the freedom agenda. Do you think that there's, even though it has new words, and surely President Trump would deny it if you asked him right out, but do you think that that's still a pattern that American foreign policy falls into when it comes to the Middle East? Or do you think it's just more of a Palestinian thing?
No, it's something we seem to fall into to some extent. But moreover, it's partly the problem of defining freedom. We define it too much around democracy and not about the building blocks of freedom upon which democracy can work, but without which they can't. And I think that, first of all, there was that big gap. The second thing is, you know, again, going back to the Iraq War. On the eve of the Iraq War, I had lunch with Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick. Many young people don't remember her. You are young enough, you may or may not, but you're also educated enough that you probably certainly do know who she is. But she was really a giant in the neoconservative movement in the 70s and 80s, the UN ambassador for the United States and so forth. So I had lunch with her and I asked her, you know, why you're really very quiet on the Iraq issue and you're really not backing it up. Why? And she said, listen, I've dealt with the Arab world a lot. And I was the voice of advocating freedom in Eastern Europe, in Asia, in Latin America. It is my career, it is my life, and my fundamental belief in the universality, the universal aspiration of freedom, except when it comes to the Middle East. And there, the Arabs try me, and they try my fundamental beliefs. And I can't, in good faith, believe that it will turn out right based on the value of freedom, which is a stunning statement from somebody as fundamentally committed to the freedom agenda as Jean Kirkpatrick, Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick, had been. I think we really have to look at freedom as a project that will take a century or two. It is a movement toward a goal. It isn't something you can simply impose right now. One probably has to start first and foremost with decentralizing power and so on and so forth. And this is a long, long-term project. So in the Palestinian case, I think this idea of reform and self-determination is really way off base. Start first with reestablishing traditional, very local patterns of politics that actually are more connected to the reality on the ground. And then in a long period of time, something may develop. But to try to go straight toward a Palestinian state with a reformed government, which is sort of the attempt to square once again our liberal values with our commitment to Israel and commitment to freedom and the reality of that, it's not going to work. It's not going to work, but it keeps reappearing.
I want to go back to your conversation with Jean Kirkpatrick, because I think it brings up a really interesting point, which is that neoconservative foreign policy, right? It really started out as in a way, the freedom agenda, right? As mostly pushing back against the Soviet Union, but also other countries. And yet by reputation, and really by people who ought to know better, educated people too, they think it's all about just invading countries and overthrowing. Yeah. Maybe you can explain, as someone who's a pretty big figure, what neoconservative foreign policy means, and also maybe what's the difference between that and, I think, a more favored term among conservatives these days, which is realism.
The neoconservative, you know, I have a fairly purist view of what neoconservatism is, which is a group of people who moved toward the conservative side of the spectrum in the 70s, 60s, and 70s in rebellion against the new left, who were largely students of Leo Strauss. But, you know, let's use the more broad term, the more popular one, which is essentially just a very conservative, robust Reaganite foreign policy. And I think that's really the way to understand it. It was Reagan. And neoconservatism really has to be understood as a Cold War idea, namely that we fundamentally believed that the Soviet Union was a tyranny, did not represent the people of Eastern Europe. It was our main journals, things were called captive minds. There was a fundamental belief in the enslaving that had been undertaken by the Soviet Union of its people. And as a result, the purpose of strategy, the purpose of the Cold War, was to rip the people away from the Soviet grip and help them overcome their regime and get in a post-Soviet world. And Ronald Reagan himself, in a speech I believe it was 86 or something like that, where he basically said it's time to relegate, he turned the communist slogan on its head, and he said it's time to relegate communism to the ash heap of history. So there was this fundamental belief that America stood for freedom, but that was also our strategic aim. It wasn't just our values. It was a strategic aim. And it what made us attack the Soviet system from within in a way that brought it down. And 1989 was the validation of that. So the fundamental outlook of the neoconservative camp was freedom is our objective, and freedom is our best strategic ally. And it pits countries, the people of countries, against their tyrannical leaders. So the freedom agenda transplanted to the Middle East was really very much a cut and paste of the way we thought of the Cold War. I think that was where you saw a lot of the core Reaganites, such as Dick Cheney, John Bolton, and so forth. Now, among certain Jewish elements of the neoconservatives, and I realize today neoconservatism often means just Jewish conservative, but back then there were lots of neoconservatives. There was Bill Bennett, there was Dick Cheney, there was or people who were lumped into that category.
And also back then, neoconservative had all kinds of domestic meanings, right? And today people are only talking about the Iraq War, right? They're not talking about broken windows theory to stop crime.
That's right. They tended to be more to the liberal side on domestic policies and so forth.
Yeah.
Whereas traditional conservatives like abortion and so forth were more to the right. So these guys who were not Jewish, they were very Reaganite. So were the ones who were Jewish, like Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perl and so forth. But that said, I think there was an element among some of us that precisely because it was the Arab world and precisely because Iraq was seen to be an enemy of Israel, precisely because of that, we felt a moral obligation to show that we cared for the people of Iraq, namely to show we're not tribal. A very cynical foreign policy would say, well, what's the problem with Saddam Hussein? He's in a box. Iraq is weak. Their economy's completely collapsed because they're sanctioned. Isn't that a good place for him to be for Israel? And in fact, that was where I think a lot of Israeli political and military and security leaders were. That it's not broken. Don't mess with it. Iraq is contained. So don't overturn the card here. I think for some, there was an element, but we have to show we really are serious about liberating Iraq and delivering for the Iraqi people. And I think there was a slight Jewish element there that we want to overcome our tribal affiliation, so to speak, and show that we are true patriots and we truly believe in freedom. And whether that was a mistake or not is a good question, but I do believe that was sort of in the back, in the background, a little bit nagging at us. And as such, it sort of cast the neoconservatives as the only ones who really believed in Iraqi freedom, and really believed in the what some people came to call later opposing the idea of the prejudice of low expectations. But at the end of the day, that might have been a mistake. In retrospect, that might have been one of the failures of the Iraq War, was the overconfidence in the Iraqi people. By the way, that's also where Ahmad Chalabi came in, which was one thing that's very important. Some of us who were involved with the war had been studying Israel very closely. Most of the neoconservatives were not Middle East experts. Richard Perl, Wolfowitz, even Doug Feith was very well-versed in Israel, but he wasn't considered a Middle East expert. Those of us who were, Harold Rode, me to some extent, John Hanna and others, we were concerned about something. We had the Israeli war in Lebanon in 82 on our mind all the time. And we knew Israel is about as good as they get in terms of a Western country. And yes, Israel is a Western country. It's about as good as it gets in understanding the Middle East. And even so, very quickly after the invasion of 82, Israel found itself bogged down, becoming essentially a player among clans and tribes who were fighting each other, throwing Israel in as either the judge or a clan. And Israel was bleeding hard. And so our view was an invasion and colonial occupation was horrible because Israel couldn't manage it in Lebanon next door very well. How are we going to manage it in Iraq? So for us, the idea was to build an exile Iraqi army based in northern Iraq, train it, bring it up to speed, and then perhaps with some military assistance by us, but by and large, let them do the heavy lifting and let them take over immediately and do not have a major American presence. Certainly don't get too deeply involved in nation building. Let them build their nation. We can help, but let them do it. So in that sense, while the outside world sees Ahmad Chalabi as the guy who kind of delivered false intelligence that was used to finagle and manipulate the West into war, what he really was for us, he was a Charles de Gaulle-like figure who you can turn the country over to immediately or have him even liberate the country. So if Ahmad Chalabi didn't exist, we would have had to invent him for that purpose. The problem was that wasn't the American war concept. I hate to say it, but government often smushes things together. And there are two opposing camps. One was the Colin Powell camp, who's with Vietnam in mind. His outlook was, we need to go in with overwhelming force and do it ourselves, but with overwhelming force, 500,000 troops. Otherwise, we're going to get in a bloody insurgency. And then we need to deliver on the occupation by nation building and create a very successful Iraq, even if the Iraqis don't do much themselves, because the delivery of a successful Iraq will win over the hearts and minds. Again, Vietnam in mind, winning over the hearts and minds of the Iraqis. And then, of course, there was that Iran element that we talked about. But the problem was that the war plan, as it was typical of government. Okay, can't agree between this and that, so let's just put them together. And what we got was what I called the 1973 war solution, which was, you know, remember, the Egyptians wanted to attack at 6 o'clock in the evening because the sun would be in Israel's eyes as they came over the canal, and that would be a big problem for Israeli troops. They'd be blinded. But the Syrians wanted it for the same reason at 6 a.m, so they compromised and made it 2 p.m, and nobody had an advantage. Well, that's kind of what happened in Iraq, is by putting together two different concepts of the war plan, we wound up with a mess.
So when I was researching a little bit before this interview, I came across, I will say maybe I'm not well-versed in all the conspiracy theories that people like to throw at you. And so I came across two things that I thought would be interesting to discuss. First, there's apparently some document that Wesley Clark wrote where he claimed the U.S. wanted to overthrow 7 Arab countries. And then there's another one, and this is, of course, in the grand neocon conspiracy theory. You were one of the authors of a document advising Prime Minister Netanyahu in his first term called A Clean Break. And from my understanding, he took some of the advice, other parts he didn't. But it also included Iraq, Iran, and a few other elements. And people like to tie this all together and say it was some sort of big plan. Right. What do you have to say about these things? Because they seem to have come up a lot on the internet.
Yeah, well, let me start with Wes Clark. I don't know where he got this idea of 7 wars. I have no clue. But one thing I can tell you, he had been out of government for a while when the Iraq War happened. He was not involved with it. I don't know who he was talking to in the U.S. government who might have had an imagination of this. I can tell you for sure one thing, if he says there were war plans, you know, the Naval War, Army War College and the National War College has war plans in contingency for almost every nation in the world. Last I checked, when I was still in government 25 years ago, we had a war plan for a British invasion of the United States. So it's just what they do. They plan for everything. That said, about Iraq, there was no idea. I mean, I remember talking to Israeli diplomats that there was not going to be a follow-on war with Iran. It's just not going to happen. There was a great hope that America now would get serious about Iran, but there was no follow-on. So not even one additional war was out there. Not Syria, not Iran, not Libya, not North Korea, not anything. Now, were there countries we considered a threat? Countries that we believed the regimes were dangerous? Yes. I don't know how many, 6, 7, maybe, I don't know. But bottom line was there was no war plan, there was no invasion plan or anything of any of those. The second thing is about the clean break. There's a lot written about it by people who probably didn't read it. It's only 6 pages. It's not that hard to read. But the whole point of it is something that, frankly, Israel probably should be more upset about than Americans. It wasn't a war plan for Iraq. It outright said, do not invade Iraq. It said that we should work with the Jordanians. Remember, this is right after Hussein Kamal defected from Iraq, the cousin or son-in-law of Saddam, defected to Jordan, wanted to create a CIA-backed plan to overthrow Saddam. He worked with the Hashemite King Hussein. And then suddenly he decided to go back to Iraq, upon arrival, he was executed. One of the great mysteries as to why he did that. But anyway, he did do that. This is why the Hashemites were involved. We had all these things about Shiites being venerating the bloodline of the prophet. And of course, the Hashemites are the bloodline of the prophet. So you could return to the Hashemite sort of overlay of Iraq that had existed from 22 to 1958. You'd unify symbolically the Shiites and Sunnis, and you sort of work it through that way. There were these vague ideas. But the bottom line about the clean break was more than what it said about Iraq. It just said Iraq's a problem. It should be destabilized. Saddam's an enemy. But we need to work with Jordan and others, including the Iraqi National Congress, Chalabi, to do it. It said very specifically, do not invade. And the reason for it was, again, the 82 war and the looming memory of that war that we had. The interesting thing about clean break is it's the inversion of what people say it was. It was not an Israeli document to the United States to manipulate us into a grand strategic plan in the Middle East. It was an American document by Americans who understood the limits of American power to the new prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Remember, this is 1996. Benjamin Netanyahu was just taking office at this point.
Was this something that Netanyahu had asked for, or was it just like an...
No, this was completely unsolicited advice. Mm-hmm. And basically, the point of it was, listen, Israel does not understand that it is graduating from a shtetl with a flag, defending itself admirably, but it was graduating to becoming a real country with real power and actually becoming a regional power. And it's the first signs of what really, I think, emerges now as Trump's foreign policy, which is Israel is not only an asset, it is actually an anchor to American power in the region. And the more Israel understands its regional role and employs its power to secure its part of the Middle East, the more that helps the United States and helps us focus elsewhere in the world and so forth. So the document as a whole is really an inversion. It's what can Israel do now that it's graduating to become a very important element of the Western alliance for real? What can it do now? Of course, it had served very admirably in the Cold War, but in the Cold War, it really took some heavy lifting by the United States at times, like in 73. But before that, Israel, of course, had some French help. Before that, Israel did the unbelievable task of alone liberating itself in 48 to 56 and onward. But nonetheless, we had come to a point by 1996. Where it was really one of the most important Western allies in the world, because it carried water, whereas everybody else was draining, was more parasitical. Israel was a value added to the West. It was a force multiplier. It wasn't just a member of the Western Alliance. It was one of the most powerful and important members of the Western Alliance. Informing this was a different view of 1982 war than what Israelis held. For us, for me, Harold Rowe, to others, Doug Feith, the 1982 war was a major act in the Cold War that helped defeat the Soviet Union. Forget about the long-term bogging down in southern Lebanon. Two critical things happened in 82. One, the air defense systems were obliterated by Israel without much effort. Two, the air force of Assad was destroyed. Third thing was the destruction of the PLO. These were critical elements. The PLO was the orchestrating nerve center of the Soviet Union's non-aligned strategy globally. They were training, they were the ones who had, since the 60s, trained Shiite radicals that then became the Iranian Revolution. They were training all over the world, these terrorist organizations, this network of danger for the West. By destroying the PLO, it punched a hole in the center of radical third world efforts by the Soviet Union. The second thing was, after 73, there was this perception in the West that the Soviet Union was winning. Winning because in 73, Israel's air force was grounded, and the entirety of America's strategy in Europe was based on a superiority of air power rather than ground forces, and that therefore the United States messed up, and we were really hurting. And all of a sudden, Israel came back in 82 and said, no, Western air power is still completely superior. And there's no contest. And that, again, upturned the whole European balance. And those two factors, and I've talked to Soviets after the Cold War ended, and they told me those were major elements that convinced them they cannot win and broke their confidence. So for us, the Israelis were such a critical element of the West. So the whole point of the clean break was to say, step up to the plate. Now you have responsibilities. Now you have power. You can do so much more with your power. It was the inverse of what people say it was.
If only that message of how helpful Israel really is to the U.S. and U.S. national security and U.S. power around the world were, if people really heard it more in the U.S., I often feel like that's what's really missing from, you know, Israel's terrible PR and public diplomacy. So I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating.
No worries.
And we'd love to have you back sometime.
Thank you, Lahav. It's been a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at www.misgavins.org and on social media. You can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we'll be back next week.